Welcome back to another exciting edition of the Pointless Exercise Podcast. It's time to remember this crap with the current leader in the poll for best co-host of a Pointless Exercise Podcast, Mike Donahue. Mike, how are you?
All that glad handling paid off.
Yeah. Well, the commercials, I thought it was a little much. You did attack ads on Pusateri and Dave Brown, but come to expect that.
Hey, Pusateri lives in Hollywood, all right? He's jet-setting back and forth from Chicago. I've never lived more than 75 miles from the address I grew up in. That's the truth.
Yeah. So for those of you who might not know what we're talking about, there is currently a survey on pointlessexercise.com that you could take and give some feedback on the newsletter. And even if you don't read the newsletter, you can just skip those questions. And there are questions about the podcast, things we might add, things we might improve, things we might maybe I'll just cancel one of the podcasts. Who knows? And someone is going to win. It's a great prize package. They're going to win 6 free months of the Pointless Exercise newsletter. If you're new, you get a new subscription for 6 months. And if you're a current subscriber, you just don't pay for the. You get 6 months tacked on to whatever you currently have. And I know this works, because I gave one to a guy already once, and he was a month to month, and for 6 months he didn't have to pay. And I believe that if you're an annual, your renewal will get pushed back by 6 months. So, and you get to pick any T-shirt of your choice, well, any one T-shirt, I should say, from the Pointless Exercise store.
Not to complicate things, but if you do already have an annual subscription, can you gift your prize? Is it transferable by chance?
I don't know. That would be our legal. Actually, no, you could, because you would just tell me who to gift it to, and I would give it to that person instead.
So, bada bing.
Yes, you could. You could give it to your wife for a birthday present. I'm sure she's very excited.
Valuable feedback, folks. Vote early and often.
Yeah, vote early and vote often. I don't know if it increases your chances of winning or not. I don't know. Let's say it doesn't, just for the sanctity of the. And so I have the results on a podcast next week. Steve Kornacki from MSNBC is going to come, and he's going to stand in front of the big board, and he's going to break everything down. There are no mail-in ballots, because we know those are corrupt. It's a scam. Anyway,
I'll be having my election night party from Wrigleyville North.
Yeah, because FYI. I can trickle the returns out every 20 minutes. It'd be very exciting. Got some very interesting answers on the question, what guests should I have on the podcast? My favorite, as I was just going over some of the preliminary results with Mike, was two of you thought that the question was, do you want to come on the podcast? Which, it's not what it said.
Please
one
leave
of you
your
said
name
no, and the other said, well, maybe. It's like, no.
Let me record myself for a little bit first. I'll get back to
you. Maybe one of them was Praz, and he just thought he was the only one who got the survey, and he wanted to say, "I want to come on again." So
that's it. Could have been.
He did a good job. I'm sure we'll have him again. There will be some.
I enjoyed that.
There will be some more. I'm sure the Cubs will be making news here in the next few days.
Right? You mean they're going to continue to be hotter than shit? Right? This is where it starts. This is the coalescing of the epic. What do you got, a 6-game winning streak?
6 in a row.
That's it.
5 in a row, undefeated since the break.
It will be hilarious. I just thought of this. It will be hilarious if they don't lose all the way through the end of the month, and they'll still be, what, like 7 games under 500, and that's still trade everybody else. I would love that to happen, just to put them in that spot for no other reason than it would be enjoyable.
Now, you'll know that they're worried about that if they immediately call up Nick Madrigal and activate Jason Hayward. Hey, the reinforcements are coming. I love Crawley is the biggest perpetrator of this. He loves to, whenever the Cubs give out updates as to how the rehabbing guys are doing, he always tweets, "Reinforcements are on the way." It's like, Crawley, Jason Hayward is not a reinforcement.
No, and Nick Madrigal, it cuts off after the letter R, the second R.
All right, well, we are down to, we just have 7 years left.
It's 25 down, 7 to go. So pretty evenly distributed. Could get anything tonight, folks. For any era, I think most eras are pretty much represented here. So we'll see. We'll see where it falls.
So here we go. So what do you know? Five quick things about the 1988 Chicago Cubs.
Opening day, Rick Sutcliffe's fourth consecutive opening day start as the Cubs go extra innings in Atlanta and pull it out. Also, opening day was the debut of Don Zimmer, who returned after having been Jim Frey's third base coach, 84, 85, 86, and came back for the 88 Cubs at the helm in the 88 season. 1988 would be the year in which Mark Grace would get called up, replace my longtime hero, Leon Durham. Grace would go on to be runner-up for Rookie of the Year to the Cincinnati Reds, Chris Sabo. I guess not Cub related, but that makes me think that 88 was the All-Star game in Riverfront Stadium, or I might be over my skis on that, but Chris Sabo, aka Spuds McKenzie, was quite
it had to be a National League one because the Cubs had it in 90, right? And that was back in the
COVID
days when they used to alternate.
And so somehow I feel if Sabo was an All-Star as a rookie and it was in Cincinnati. I could be wrong, but basically the country was all about – it was Sabo mania. That's what did Mark Grace in 88. In 1988, a young Michael Donahue caught a ball in the stands in the bleachers from a young Doug DeCenzo for the first of two times. Second, I already mentioned, happened in 1996. I'd like to maybe revisit that story because there are some – funny things associated with that.
I was going to say somebody threw Doug DeCenzo into the bleachers and you caught him.
And I just fucked it up. It's not Doug DeCenzo. What am I thinking? It was John Cangelosi of the Pittsburgh Pirates.
Now, what's the difference?
I think it was common to make that mistake. I don't know if DeCenzo would have been up by 88.
Would you say Doug DeCenzo was the right-handed John Cangelosi?
Fair enough. Very. I think
he was right-handed, right?
This podcast would probably warrant a sort of a tale of the tape between Doug DeCenzo and John Cangelo. A lot of similarities. Italian Americans.
Also left-handed, but he is a switch hitter. That's why I remembered him batting.
That's right. Okay.
He's the most effective lefty Cub reliever in history.
Good point. Not Pat Perry, who was not, I believe, on the 88 Cubs. Was in 89, but you know who was on the 88 Cubs, Andy? For his first real full season, it seemed. I don't think he was an All-Star, but Cubs left fielder Rafael Palmeiro.
Oh, he was an All-Star.
He was. He was one of the eight. Make that the fifth fact. The Cubs had a shitload, just like they did in 2008. Five random ersatz facts about the 88
Cubs. Won
just as
many playoff games in 88 as they did in 2008.
Good point. So Palmeiro was a Cub All-Star. Not like Ron Coomer, who is a former Cub and All-Star. Rafael Palmeiro is actually a former Cub All-Star. I guess I had forgotten that fact. Forgotten that crap.
I believe he may have been leading the National League in hitting at the All-Star break.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll take your word for it. I'll tell you.
How many tests? Rafael Palmeiro, who retired with 3,000 hits and 500 home runs, one of the few people who did that, and he likes some injectable vitamins, so he's not going to get in the Hall of Fame. He won. He won that one bogus Gold Glove, but he also won
just one. But he won more. He won more than one total, but one was bogus.
That was his third in a row.
Okay,
it was one of those where people were just used to voting for him, even though he DH'd almost the whole year. He won a Gold Glove. How many times in his 20-year career do you think Rafael Palmeiro was an All-Star?
The way you phrase it would make me guess that his Cub appearance was the only one, but that can't be correct. So I'm going to just say it's still seemingly low and say three.
Four. He only made the All-Star team four times. A career 288 hitter, 3,000 hits. I guess he was a good player. He wasn't just a compiler. He was a good. He led the league. He led the American League in hits one year. He led the American League in doubles one year. He led the league in runs one year.
Well, wait a sec. Who are these, the first basemen in the American League that were keeping him out? McGuire? Mattingly? Maybe Carlos, Mattingly.
Carlos Delgado.
Okay.
There's probably great ones out there that I can't think
okay.
of.
Well, that's, you know, that's two. You're not going to, you know, really not going to have more than three anyway. So he's, you know.
John Olerud.
And his batting helmet.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, tough luck.
Greg Walker. Keeping him out. Well, Frank Thomas.
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah. I could see where Frank might make more all-star teams than Raffy.
Yeah. All right. So tough luck for Raffy. Oddly enough, of course, not a first baseman. Never really was a first baseman for the Cubs.
Brian Daubach. You might have been keeping him out.
We got a
Cecil Fielder. Would have been Fred McGriff.
Yeah.
With Toronto and the Rays, maybe.
Toronto in the early. Well, when did McGriff get traded
to
Atlanta?
He was in Atlanta
in 93, but that was in 93.
They were kind of ships passing in the. Raffy got there in 89.
Oh, American League, like the Cubs franchise. The American League in the 80s and 90s, like the Cubs franchise for the last 50 years. A lot of good first basemen. Of course, the Cubs are so good, as we've talked about at first, that Palmeiro didn't even really use his first baseman's mitt because opening day was Leon Durham's last opening day with the Cubs. And then at some point in early May, the much ballyhooed Mark Grace finally got his call up. So
in San Diego, wearing what number?
I thought it was 53, but we talked about it before. It wasn't 17.
28. That's because that's the number. That's the extra one Yosh packed. That's how cheap the Cubs were back then. Couldn't stitch a number on a jersey for the rookie. I want to be 17. Well, you can wait till we get back to Chicago, kid. Then we can give you your real number.
So, Grace, well, I guess I did not, I'm not interjecting this in light of current events, but I will say that Grace and a teammate of his the year before at Pittsfield, Massachusetts, were the object of this prospect pervert's attention every week when the Sporting News would come out, which, of course, the Sporting News was the only way. Go ahead.
Was it the handsome, super tan Damon Berryhill?
It was not. It was the moment of silence, the just recently deceased Dwight Smith.
Oh, yes, Dwight Smith.
Teammates on the 87 Pittsfield Cubs, and what I remember, and maybe this won't stand the test of time, but I seem to remember that Grace and Smith were 1-2 in batting in the 1987, I guess it would be Eastern League. And not to be, you know, casting stares at other ball players while my guy Leon Durham was still, you know, toughing it out at first base for the Cubs. But I was very intrigued by the names Grayson Smith on the 87 Cubs. Smith would stay down in 88 for a little more seasoning. His story, you know, we've already told
her. Try to learn how to catch a fly ball, something never
quite grasped. And so he stayed out, but Grace got the call up in 88. And, you know, pretty much it's one of those cases where the prospect panned out. And he was, you know, one of the more fun players to watch over the course of the next 13 years. But, yeah, made his debut. And so long, Bull Durham.
So while I was looking this up, I missed. Did you say which one won the batting title?
Was it Smith? Because I would have guessed Grace.
Dwight Smith batted 337. Mark Grace batted 333. Dwight Smith
and they
pitched
were
him out for the batting title.
Okay.
In Pittsfield. Pittsfield Cubs, one of the all-time greatest minor league teams of all time.
Berryhill on the roster? Managed by whom in 88? Would it be like Charlie Fox or somebody?
Oh, no. It would be the great Jim Essien. 87-51. They were the for all you prospect perverts out there, they would have been the 80s version of the current Myrtle Beach Pelicans. Listen to the guys on this team. It's Cub greats everywhere. Dwight Smith, Mark Grace, Rolando Rooms hit 308 for them. The aforementioned Doug DeCenzo hit 307. A handsome young catcher by the name of Hector Villanueva hit 274 with 14 homers.
Not Damon Berryhill. Oh, Berryhill was already up by 88. Yeah. He was probably AAA and up. Yeah, yeah, okay.
The other catcher was also a future Cub, Rick Rona. He hit exactly what you'd think, 220. A major leaguer who I don't believe ever played for the Cubs.
Try me.
He's best known as a Seattle Mariner outfielder. And yes, he never did play for the Cubs. Let's see how he got to Seattle. Maybe I'll tell you who he got traded for, and then you can figure out who it is. Where is it? I'm struggling on this live podcast here. I don't see his transactions. That's great. Huh. Rich Amaral.
I would not have been able to guess that. So
I forgot he was ever a Cub. He had a relatively long.
I don't remember Rich Amaral.
10-year major leaguer.
And he was on the 88 Pittsfield Cubs as all these future Cubs?
Yes. I wonder why. Maybe it's because I'm on the.
These are all, by the way, just not to.
I got to know keep how he got there.
Beating the Dallas Green. What great drama. Trade. These are all probably Dallas Green picks.
Oh. Well, this is quality roster management. He was a second-round draft pick of the Cubs in the 83 draft. He was lost in the Rule 5 draft to the White Sox in the 88 Rule 5 draft. That's how he left. Never made it with the White Sox either. They cut him, and he signed with the Mariners, and then he played 10 years in the big leagues for the Mariners.
Good for him. 88 Rule 5 was after the 88 season, then, because he was on the 88 Pittsfield Cubs. Right. Okay.
Would have been that those winter meetings. That's the other Cubs who made it off the 88. Laddie Renfro.
Oh, God. Don't trick. Come on. We did a deep dive on that poor bastard in 91.
Oh, one of their prized number one draft picks got to pitch in one game at the 88. Must have got a start late
Mike,
in the year.
Well, Mike Harkey?
Yes, Mike Harkey. Cub pitcher who made the probably the greatest debut of a Cub pitcher of all time. Pitched for the Pittsfield Cubs.
Later this season, I believe. Jeff Pico.
Jeff Pico.
Yeah,
Dickie Knowles did a rehab of who knows which kind of rehab Dickie was doing in Pittsfield. So they got to rub elbows with greatness, and a guy by the name of Rich Scheid, who I believe
Rich Scheid has been brought up
and the White Sox, right?
Rich Scheid was he was mentioned before, believe it or not, on this podcast because he and I believe Dean Wilkins were both traded for Steve Trout after Trout threw his back-to-back shutouts in 87. I want to say the Cubs got back Rich Scheid and Dean Wilkins.
That is right. So, and then he was traded by
the Cubs to the Sox, you said?
Traded by the Cubs to the Sox for the great Chuck Mount. He would later get traded from the Sox to the Astros for Eric Yelding.
I remember Eric Yelding. Yeah. Sure you do, too.
All right. I forget. I interrupted you. Did we get through all of your five fun facts about the 88?
Oh, yeah. Cubs? We did like six or seven. It started bleeding all over. You know, Jeff Pico could have been a fun fact because, yes, as you've pointed out just now, a member of the 88 Cubs. I think we pointed out, too, before that Pico and Grace both of their first wives, at least in Grace's case, were sisters from Peoria.
They were nuns?
Which would have probably
well, that's a scandal.
Part of the Church of, yes, the Blessed Virgin Mary
Peoria,
Order.
Peoria Chiefs sneaking into the
convent.
Into the convent and running out with a girl. Now you've got to marry these girls now.
Right. This is all conjecture. But anyway, Jeff Pico, another fun fact, did make his debut in 88. And of course, I think any Cub fan pretty much over the age of 42 will tell you that Jeff Pico threw a shutout in his major league debut at Wrigley Field.
Has any other Cub done that? I don't know.
I can just tell you that I believe Sean Boskey in 1990 threw a complete game in his debut. I'm almost positive. But no. And Pico also threw another shutout. He threw two shutouts in 88. He threw one against the Mets in late June that was, I'm pretty sure it was 88. Yeah, I'm pretty sure Pico threw two shutouts as a rookie. All these guys you mentioned, too, like I don't know about Rolando Rooms, but even that guy that somehow managed to be a forgotten 10-year veteran of the Mariners, all drafted by Dallas Green. This is peak Dallas Green. It's starting to become really emergent, and he's already gone, which is just kind of a wistful sort of pondering. But, you know, I mean, that whole lineup.
Yeah, Jeff Pico, 6-7 for the 88 Cubs with 3 complete games and 2 shutouts.
Yeah, 1 against the Mets. I think the debut is against the Reds.
ERA of 4.15. So he was either really good or...
Right, 2 shutouts.
So do I need to... should I just drop in the rant from the 85 Remember This Crap podcast with our special guest, Kelly Dwyer, where I talk about my dog dying and the drought and the All-Star game and Whitey Herzog not playing Sean Dunstan? Probably not. But you can listen.
Well, I never heard. Yeah, go back to that. But we can, and that's a pretty poignant, hilarious, and painful story, but it's all good. But there are other things about that. Like we said, there are 8 players that made that All-Star game. I think the one most auspicious one was just the guy who had the hot as hell start to the season, was the huge, bespectacled former White Sox Vance Law, the opening day third baseman who just got off to a good start and really rode that glory.
Big year for third baseman in the National League that year, apparently. Bobby Bonilla was playing third. He got to start the All-Star game.
For the Pirates?
Yeah.
Okay.
The other third baseman on the roster, there's only 2, Vance Law and the aforementioned and the rookie of the year, Chris Sabo.
Was that game in Riverfront Stadium, by the way?
Piece of shit he was. It was, yes.
Yeah.
Played in it was 2-1, played in a cool 2 hours and 26 minutes.
Damn. You know, of course, we're peak Sandberg. He's in his 84, you know, 8, 4, 5, 6, 7. He's in his 4th All-Star game. Who were the others? So Palmeiro?
Cubs had
Maddox.
Cubs had 2 starters.
Yeah, Maddox and
Sutcliffe? Real starters, not starting pitchers. They had 2 All-Star starters, voted in by your fans.
Andre?
Yes, Andre Dawson and...
The reigning MVP and Ryan Sandberg.
Yes, so 2 Cub Hall of Famers started the game. The other Cubs on the All-Star team were Vance Law, Sean Dunstan.
Yeah, that's right.
Rafael Palmeiro.
Right.
Greg Maddux.
Yep.
And
Maddux did not pitch either.
I don't see him on here, but I always thought Sutcliffe was on there.
So maybe it's just 6, not 8. I think the 2008, maybe they both had 6.
And a lot.
Yeah, it is. No, it was, I'm happy with 6. So interesting thing now that you mentioned it about Maddux is this was Greg.
6 for a team that won 77 games.
But it's funny too. I mean,
their Pythagorean. This is what a good job Don Zimmer did. Their Pythagorean record should have been 162.
You're joking.
He was right on the dot. 77, 85, and 1, and that's what.
And boy, Zim.
That's what Pythagoras said too. 77 and 85. So Zimmer, he wrung the absolute optimum amount out of that team.
Came back for another year, and magic happened. It's funny that all those All-Stars, of course, were basically Jim Frey didn't bring anybody in his first year. We didn't know what a disaster he was going to be. A little bit of optimism, you know, because they were young All-Stars, a little bit of mix. Oh, I'm sorry, Vance Law. My apologies. Vance Law was the one All-Star that Jim Frey brought in. But I want to circle back real quick and just point out that this was like the first emergence of Maddux, who was like hotter than shit going into the All-Star break. He did not pitch in the game because he was so goddamn hot that they didn't want to, like, you know, cool him off. And he started on the Sunday before the All-Star game. So he didn't get to pitch in the first All-Star game that he was named to, but it was such a pleasantly delightful thing to just see happen in front of your own eyes. Maddux was this guy that the year before had gone 6-14. He got sent down, which we haven't talked about because we haven't done 87. And the Andre Dawson gets beamed in the face game where Maddux, you know, retaliated. We'll see whether or not that was apocryphal, and we don't need to go into it now because it didn't happen in 88. But anyway, Maddux up and down, struggled. Jimmy Moyer looked like, if you go by win-loss, looked like he might project to be the better pitcher. That's bullshit. And Jerome Holtzman tried to tell me as much when I read that when he was interviewing Dick Pohl before a game. And I think most insiders – sense Maddux was going to be special, even though the numbers didn't bear it out in 87. And sure enough, in 88, after a few weeks, he just he was one of the best pitchers around, and pretty much didn't stop for about 17 years from that point.
His first half stats, and I remember the record off the top of my head. Do you remember what his record was at the All-Star break?
It was like 14-3 or something?
Yeah, it was 15-3. So you're like, oof, we're going to have a surefire
25-game winner.
20-game winner. It's going to be no problem.
No, 25, which would make him the first since his Steve Stone up in the broadcast.
He's 15-3 with a 2.14 ERA. He threw 8 complete games and 19 starts and 3 shutouts in the first half. He only gave up 118 hits in 155 innings. He only struck out 91. He wasn't striking anybody out, but he also, and he walked more than he was at 51. For him, that's a lot.
Wow. He was still figuring it. He was still figuring it out, man. He was racking up.
And in the second half, he went 3-5 with a 4.92 ERA and 15 starts. He threw one complete game. He gave up 112 hits in 93 innings. He struck out 49 batters in 93 innings in the second half. He was pooped, as they like to say.
But you know what? My takeaway there too is like how much you probably fucking learned through all that failure in the second half of that season.
Well, he had the great Dick Pohl guiding him.
He did.
He was in good shape, I think. Well, it could have been Billy Connors. I think it was Dick Pohl, right? Didn't Dick come in with?
Connors was on Fry's staff. So this is between Fry and Zimmer. So, I mean, I'd have to think about it. I think when Fry got canned as manager, Connors was like, oh, I couldn't tell you who Gene Michaels' pitching coach was. I'm pretty sure Pohl came in with Zimmer. I'm sure it was Pohl's first. Oh, maybe not. I don't know. I can't answer that. Don't know I used to probably know who the Cubs pitching coach was every single season.
Why doesn't this list the coaches? Now, you said they didn't bring anybody in for this season, but Jim Fry made a big move in the offseason. Not long after he wrestled control of the franchise, yep. He was named general manager on the 11th of November, and on the 8th of December, he made a big trade.
Oh, gosh. I thought you were talking about – he also made an in-season trade, which we'll obviously get to, but you were referring, of course – to dealing Lee Arthur Smith.
Yes, traded a Hall of Fame reliever for Kelvin Schiraldi and Al Nipper. Attaboy. Great job.
I said
Kelvin Schiraldi after we all watched him shit his pants on the mound and he didn't just shit his pants in the World Series, he did it in the ALCS too.
I think you discovered that, you pointed that out recently, on a recent podcast. Yeah, sure, let's bring that. It's kind of like when the Cubs like traded for Anthony Young. Like, you're just tempting fate. Well, this guy set the record for most consecutive losses. You can't go. There's nowhere to go but up.
Actually, I'll give Kelvin a little credit. He did. He lost a game in the ALCS, but he pitched well in the other three that he pitched in. In the World Series, however, he pitched 3 times, and his ERA was 13.5, and he was a huge contributor to blowing Game 6.
He was. He and Bob Stanley. Kelvin Schiraldi was actually a highly touted Mets prospect, correct?
Yes.
Coming on the heels of, like, Dwight Gooden and Ron Darling in around the time of Sid Fernandez. And I can't even offhand think of the trade that there had to be some big Red Sox that ended up on the 86 Mets. All we know is that he was facing.
It's a trade with a lot of names, and only one guy kind of stands out, mostly because he cut his finger off and he was an Indian. In November 13th, 85, the trade was...
Bob Ojeda?
Yeah, Christensen, Wes Gardner, Lachelle Tarver, and Kelvin Schiraldi to the Red Sox. Okay. Chris Baer, Tom McCarthy, John Mitchell, and Bob Ojeda.
Bob Ojeda is the only one any of us should have any right to recognize.
Now, do you remember when the Cubs traded him away the next year, who they got?
I do. Your buddy Marvell Wynn?
Well, and?
No.
Yes. But there was probably a little more important part of that trade.
Luis Salazar?
Yes, Luis Salazar.
Yes.
Okay. It was Darren Jackson, Kelvin Schiraldi, and then player named later was Phil Stevenson.
And Darren Jackson also did, because 85 is when he showed up on my TV screen on Monday Night Baseball instead of either Bob Denier or Billy Hatcher, the Kurt Urkel-voiced White Sox broadcaster, also a member of the 88 Cubs and another Dallas Green draft pick. Team is riddled with Dallas. This Dallas Green farm just coming to life here.
So now, Jim Frey, not, you know, he's a savvy wheeler dealer. He wasn't going to just install Calvin Schiraldi as the closer. Do you remember who he signed? A free agent, biggest free agent acquisition to close
actually,
the Cubs.
And I believe Schiraldi was acquired with the intention of making him a starter.
Yeah, he did. He believed he started. He's listed. He started 27 games.
Yeah. Like, oh, the problem was you put him in late pressure situation. Yeah. If you let him start again, he'll be awesome. So to replace the actual closer, let's get that old pair of balls that calls himself Goose Gossage.
Goose Gossage. It's funny. When you think of Goose with the Cubs, right? I mean, that's an old dude. Like, ancient. You know how old he was? 36.
Still old by 1988.
No, but he looked like he was 50.
He was old and ineffective. And, you know, he was one of the most dominant closers for whatever a closer was in the early 80s. And he was a White Sox starter for years. I mean, he'd been around a while. And, yeah, it was like, you know, Lee Smith was as good as you could get. I think I took him for granted because I would sort of linger on the games he blew. Like, he blew like a handful of Sutcliffe's games in 87, which probably cost the Red Baron his second Cy Young. And, you know, he gave up the homer to Garvey, but like, what do you want out of closers, especially back then, pitching so much? And obviously, in retrospect, that's about.
Well, I didn't like him because Lee would sleep in the clubhouse till like the third or fourth inning. It's like, he's not pitching.
That stuff doesn't bother.
He's
it's just
not pitching
there's
until
more
the ninth, before. Jim.
Yeah. They were just being nitpicky.
The 1988 like, Cubs, you know how many saves they had as a team?
How many saves pitchers collectively acquired? Is it less than 20?
It was 29. It was 11th in the what? The then 13 team National League?
12. It was 12 and 14.
Even. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right. They were. I remember there were 26 teams.
Yep, 6-6 in each division. So
only one team had fewer saves than the Cubs.
Okay. And did Gossage lead the team in saves?
He did, with 13.
Did Les Lancaster vulture a save?
Frank DePino had 6. Lester Lacknaster had 5. Pat Perry had 1.
And oh, he was an
Drew
88
Hall.
Call.
Drew Hall had a save. Yeah. Calvin had a save. Al Nipper had a save. Hey, everybody gets a save. Why not?
I can't believe Drew Hall actually saved a game.
Jeff
I don't
Pico
recall him
save.
Ever getting called up. Oh, all right.
Jeff Pico threw 2 shutouts, 3 complete games, and got a save. Talk about a...
Probably an extra inning game, I bet.
Talking Maybe. About your rookie of the... He should have been rookie of the year. I don't know who won that year, but it should have been Jeff Pico. He was
it's Chris Sabo. We already went over this. And
Mark Grace finished second.
This was where, of course, remember, too, that Grace was the first of 3 consecutive runner-ups of rookie of the year. Dwight Smith, his teammate from the year before, would be the runner-up the next year. And, of course, the aforementioned already, Mike Harkey would be the runner-up in 1990. And that's not even mentioning Jerome Walton won the damn thing the next year.
Yeah.
So.
Well, it was, yeah, Gordon Goldsberry knew what he was doing. That's why Jim Frey had to fire him.
I hate to dwell on the point, but I feel like everything I look at keeps coming back to that, like how tragic it was that the whole field is littered with these blooming prospects that Dallas Green had spent 6 years planting. That now knowing what happens in the subsequent 3 seasons and how much salt.
What would the Cubs of our youth have looked like had the Cubs never hired Jim Frey to do anything?
Well, does Lee Elia lead them through San Diego? Yeah, does that even happen?
Somebody, some other manager who's not him. And then he's not around to become the GM and fuck that up.
Yeah, I mean, his time as a manager, I'm not going to be critical because it's easy to nitpick on how he managed the rotation in the playoffs, blah, 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 and his stupid, like you say, is like indoor track shoes that he would waddle out there. And his time as the GM though almost undoes all the good he did as a manager, I feel like, in my book. And it's just so worthless and really one of the worst periods. And that's really, there's a lot of competition for worst general managers. Considering the resources he had, the inertia that he had, the momentum that he had that was building up and just completely fucking just squat on it and like dissolve it unintentionally and frustratingly. You know, this was kind of the peak. It, I mean, they, Jesus, you know, Dawson and Vance Law are the only guys over 30 on this roster, and they would win a division the next year. So, still a Jerry Mumphrey on the roster in 88. We give Jerry his due. He was on his way out in 88, though. Don't look at his numbers.
Oh, no.
He performed better than I think we had appreciated. He was kind of an underrated player, maybe.
Yeah, I had already realized. In 86, he hit .304 for the Cubs, and in 87, he hit .333 for the Cubs. And it's not like he played, 40 games. He played 111 games in 86, 118 games in 87.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was done in 88.
De Niro's getting banged up.
And that was his last season in the majors. Cubs have that effect on a lot of people. Where
they do.
Finish things.
They did. So I'm not sure the game in particular. I'm sure I could find it, but I wanted to just quickly relate an anecdote that would have occurred in 88 when I was a 16-year-old. And at the time, I had two brothers that were both recent college graduates that aged, I think, like 23, 25, that had gotten an apartment just off the intersection of Clark, Sheffield, and Newport. And so I would find reasons, especially in the summer, to make my way down there and have a place to, to crash and whatnot. And so I went to a few games. I was, working that summer, so I wasn't completely irresponsible and a total bleacher bum. But I do remember it was a Pittsburgh series because Rick Rushel was pitching against the Cubs, so that was kind of a thrill. But I went to back-to-back games, and so the first one was I had to get in the first row and save a couple of seats for my brother and his buddy. They were getting off of work early, and and because I was around older adults, I don't remember much of the afternoon after they arrived. They were quick to indulge a 16-year-old. But then the next day, again, I'm not working, they're at work, I'm going to the game by myself, and so I sit out in the bleachers again. And this time I'm sitting in left field, and I'm not sure it's June 13th, 14th, or 15th, because I'm figuring school is out, and that's the first place that I'm heading. So this is what happens on one of those dates. I'm in the first row. I may have still brought my glove, although I don't think I did, being 16. By myself, first row, left field, and taking batting practice were the Pirates and the aforementioned John Cangelosi. Now, we did 1996, and I mentioned that we chatted up John Cangelosi then as a member of the Astros days after he was involved in a huge brawl precipitated by Danny Darwin and Jeff Juden, where Jeff Juden was a pitcher for the Expos, and he hit Cangelosi, and Cangelosi charged him out and actually somehow managed to pick up Juden and dump him like in a WrestleMania move. And I was calling Cangelosi Rocky then, and he was playing up to it, and we were having fun with Danny Darwin. It was a good time, but that was in 96. In 88, Cangelosi at this point had already been a flame-out opening day center fielder for the White Sox. He would be very much like Doug DeCenzo, who, short Italian-American, left-hander, as we learned. But here's what happened in 88. Sitting next to me in the front row in the left field bleachers was a young couple, a few years older than me, early 20s, mid-20s, guy and his girlfriend. And the girlfriend had a little bit of a halter top on, and we were both sort of, she was kind of getting Cangelosi's attention. And I'm just trying to get anyone's attention that might throw a ball up and just soak in the atmosphere. And at some point, Cangelosi kind of started, he got the girl got his attention. And she was asking for a ball, and let's say negotiations kind of began. And at one point, she started teasing, pulling down her top. And all I'm going to say is that I was looking straight to my left at her because I'm 16. I'm a loser. I'm not getting anywhere. Oh, my God. I'm this close to a girl about to show her breast in the bleachers at Wrigley. And as that's happening, I see out of the corner of my eye a ball about to hit me in the face. And I turn, I throw my hands up, and I catch the ball at John Cangelosi. And I realize years later, I think Cangelosi was looking to have a laugh and get the 16-year-old, drooling, pubescent teenager to basically get caught, trying to grab a look while he's throwing the ball at my face. Luckily, my instincts pulled in. I pulled back in time and got the ball by Cangelosi, but those were interesting times in the bleachers. I'll leave it at that. I almost got a show and instead went home with the baseball.
So I don't know what I was just looking. I don't exactly know which of the games it was, but there was a June series, late June series between the Cubs and the Mets that I went to, where I got the my famous Tim Tuffle,
The Tim Tuffle
my
ball.
Tim Tuffle ball. And what I remember about the game was two things. Number one, we walked in. It was my dad and me and my friend Danny, and we walked in at the top of the bleachers, and we heard a ball hit the true link fence. And Danny ran over and grabbed it, and it was an Andre Dawson batting practice home run. Just walks in the freaking thing, and there it is. So I remember thinking there was no way in hell that I, you know, it's like, well, fine, you got a ball. You got, well, I ended up with one too. But what I also remember is that in the game, Darryl Strawberry, playing right field for the Mets, managed to let a fly ball go over his head for a double,
Yep.
and Danny and I got the Darryl chant
Yep.
started. It was
You
very,
got it started.
yes, we were very proud of that. We started immediately, and the drunken bleacher fans were more than happy
Yes.
to get it going. And poor Darryl standing there, slumped.
When we talk 1984, I'm going to have a story about participating in what I feel is one of the earliest ever Darryl chants. But yeah, that's good time. Now, interestingly, that would probably have been that weekend that Jeff Pico threw his second shutout against the Mets. The late June. The next time the Mets came to town, and this was not mentioned earlier, and it's probably we should we're probably definitely going to spend some time discussing this historic fact. But the Mets came back in town in August and would participate against the Cubs in the first ever night game to ever take place at Wrigley Field. And I only bring up that game
I don't
because
remember what date that was. Does anybody remember what date that was?
it's the anniversary's coming up. It, of course, is August 9th, right? But most Cub fans have to sort of do some math when they
Yes.
figure it out
Remember that
because you always need,
88, they drug that
yeah,
poor old
and you
guy
got
out to
to.
hit the plunger. Let there be lights.
His name was Harry Grossman, Andy.
And I believe Marquee over the All-Star break replayed the broadcast of the truncated, the rained out game, because this is back when the Cubs knew how to have fun. The entire broadcast was Harry Carey, Steve Stone, and Bill Murray.
And a
Not
lot of
like
other.
Bill didn't breeze by the booth for a half inning. Bill was just there and really funny. Like,
Right.
you know, it's he laid out when he didn't have any, and you know, it was I've watched much longer of that than I intended to, just because it's like, all right, this is a guy being this is an actual Cub fan who is one of the funniest people around, who knows when to talk and when to just let Harry and Steve do the game. It was a lot of fun. Hopefully they'll
And
do the
there,
same with Jeff Garland sometime. That'd be great.
I, but now that you mention that, I do not remember. There was also a rotating cast of other celebrities, and I only remember that because my dad started getting really annoyed because at some point it's like, why the fuck is Dabney Coleman in the booth? And he was like, he was, and I know this happened. He looked it up, and Dabney Coleman, give him credit, he's a baseball fan. He happened to be in Chicago, and I remember he was like distracted by the game and pointing out that he's trying to follow the Dodgers game because this young Ramon Martinez that we've been hearing about is taking the bump for the Dodgers. Of course, Ramon, not Dusty's little pet middle infielder,
Right.
Ramon, but Pedro's big
Pedro's
brother, who
brother,
seemed
yeah.
to have been a much hot, much more highly touted prospect, I feel like, at least as evidenced by Dabney Coleman's tout on
Oh yeah.
8888.
In fact,
But
to Tommy Lasorda, Pedro was always just Ramon's little brother, and he was going to be way too little and frail to be a good big league pitcher, which is why they traded him to the Expos. That was Lasorda was like, yeah, we don't, he's not going to make it. Hall of Famer Pedro Martinez.
yeah.
There you go, Tommy, you prick.
Yeah, good move, Tommy. So yeah, but there were a lot of festivity. Mike Royko wrote one of his more memorable articles about, I mean, there was just so much excitement. It's great. I mean, again, everyone, even like if you're 22 and listening to this, I know there are a couple of you, you know the history, but it does sometimes make me pause to think like how strange it was that for like four goddamn decades, because you know, once Cincinnati's Crosley Field got lights in what, like 1938? Within like 10 years, everybody except Wrigley Field fell,
Well,
you
the
know,
famous story about
out
they
with few.
had they
And the
bought the
Cubs would have
steel
been one of the
for it.
first.
They were gonna put them up, and then the war started,
And I believe that is actually not apocryphal.
And PK
but...
donated the to the war effort. They probably made some, I don't know, they made a battle cruiser or some bombs.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, guys, war's over. He probably could go with the light thing now. Ah, screw it.
Yep. Yeah, so as early as 1948, being the only, you know, they, it was a not, they were a novelty. I mean, into the 50s. I think 48, I'm just plucking that, but I'm pretty sure by 1950, for sure, every team had lights. Maybe some had traditions, local home rule. They couldn't play games in certain days, night games in certain days, but for the most part, you're dealing with a major league ballpark that for 50, 60, for 30, or 38, almost 40 years, had this unique feature where all 81 home games were played during the day. Now, as kids growing up in the 70s and 80s, and certainly in 88, when that finally changed, it was, you know, essential. It was, you know, it was a big part of us. It was a great benefit. You know, you spend your summers, you go to the pool, you come back, you play some pickup ball, whatever. The game's always on. You catch a few innings, you watch the whole game. It's part of the reason the Cubs caught on nationwide, you know, this, that, and the other thing. But of course, it's, you know, probably not that helpful to you, you know, strategically when, you know, you're playing in the hot Chicago summers constantly. Although the 84 Cubs did seem to turn that against their opponents. Nevertheless, it just, that could not last forever. And it was really one of Dallas Green's, you know, he recognized that early on and he didn't play that card early on and people were already paranoid about it. But sure enough, he did bring lights to Wrigley Field and is what, he was gone by the time it happened. That's how long it took.
He already got fired before the lights went up.
He wasn't even,
Two things that caught my attention about that, the broadcast from August 8th, 1988 was how fat Rick Sutcliffe was. And Steve Stone talking about how Rick has been battling back problems. And you're looking at him like, well, gee, I wonder why. He looks like Rick Rushel, not Rick Sutcliffe. And then realizing that Murray was still there was he, they showed Commissioner A. Bartlett Giamatti. And
Commissioner. So this is the brief window in time when he was, I think he was NL president. Are you sure he was commissioner? All right.
Oh, wait. 88. Yeah, I think he was commissioner in 88.
I think it was, he was not commissioner for long. He was NL president for long.
He was commissioner in 88 and 89.
Okay. So Hugh Roth was on the way out. Okay.
And Bill goes, hey, he goes, oh, he's here. He goes, is Bowie Kuhn here? He goes, is he still trying to give away our playoff game, our home playoff games?
Which is not true, but
no,
yes.
It's not true. In fact, the Bowie had to rule that they did not change the playoff.
We've talked about it. That's one of those apocryphal things that has caught on. And Bill, you know, was perpetrating. I think we all believe that to be true in 88. But the Cubs did not lose home field advantage in the NLCS in 84 because they didn't have lights. But they would have faced punishment in 85 if they didn't. They would not have played games at Wrigley Field. And I think you said,
well, maybe I need to give Murray credit. Maybe what he said, maybe he was looking for Uberoth. Because that Uberoth did give it, but it didn't matter because
right. Because Kuhn was on his way out.
Yeah, Bowie was done at the end of the 84th season, and Uberoth had just wrapped up the 1984 Olympics, the first Olympics supposedly to make money. I'm sure they really didn't. and took over as commissioner, and he was there in 85. He was the one who, you know, when the Cubs were cruising along in June, as we talked about
before the 13th game,
everybody was worried
right.
about, oh shit, they're going to make the playoffs again, and they don't have lights, and they're going to fuck up our national TV thing. He was going to make them. Where did you say they had to go to St. Louis to play?
Busch Stadium, not even Comiskey. They wanted to do a National League Park, the closest National League Park, and the Brewers were still in the American League.
Ugh, can you imagine that?
I know. Nice that the Cubs rendered that moot, I suppose. By virtue of the 13-game losing streak.
On that awful self-aggrandizing documentary, which debuted about a year ago, right? They did the Cubs.
Which one?
The one they made, the Cubs pat themselves on the back for renovating Wrigley Field. I don't know if you remember that movie.
Yeah.
They give themselves credit for, because of the way they structured the remodeling, that under their original plan in 2016, they would have been playing games either in Milwaukee or U.S. Comiskey, but they won the World Series playing their home games in Wrigley because they fuck off. Like it would have been the dumbest thing ever to have actually abandoned the park for an entire season. Don't give us that shit.
right.
The reason people thought that was going to happen is the Cubs were floating it so that they would seem like, honestly, I'm sure it was a way to make fans bitch less about the inconveniences of the park being torn up while they were in it. This, huh? We could, how'd you like? We could be up in Milwaukee right now playing our home games. How'd you like that?
Yeah.
That's just their typical shit. Was it Phil Bradley? Is that who hit the home run?
Lead off homer.
And then Ryan answered with a homer. And then none of that counted.
It got washed away, and then celebrity interviews, and then like Maddox and Jody might have still been on the Cubs. He got traded late to Atlanta. I think we went over there. He got traded like at September 3rd.
Who did the tarp sliding? Is that what you're...
Yeah, the tarp sliding.
I know it was Maddox, and it was Lester Lacknaster, and I think it was probably Nipper, because that's just the kind of guy he was.
Sure, sure.
And it really pissed Brian Zimmer off.
It did?
Yeah. God forbid anybody have any fun.
Yeah.
What if they got hurt?
Yeah.
Well, he'd still finish in fourth.
So the reason I do want to spend a minute to go over the game the next day, the true official night. And so, yeah, I mean, and just to put it to rest, there was so much national hoopla, and obviously we know it now. We see it now with the Cubs every now and then, but it was like we're talking like Letterman, national news. It was as you can imagine, an epochal event, and then the irony of it getting washed out. But as a result, we still remember 8888. But then 8988, the Mets come to town, and then it just so happened that NBC had gotten into line to get, you know, what they thought originally was the second ever night game, and because of the previous night's rainout, would be the first. And so a rare weeknight NBC game of the week type production broadcast with good old Vince Scully and Joe Garagiola coming to town. And I like to reference this game because, kids, you can find it in its entirety on YouTube, or at least you could as recently as a year ago. And when you can, Cubs won. The Mets would, by the way, win their second division but lose the Dodgers. The playoffs, the Mets are like very good year in and year out. We discussed that when we talked about 85. But fast forward to about the sixth or seventh or eighth inning, and I don't know if it's Barry Hill or who, hits a deep drive to right center, and Mets center fielder Lenny Dykstra gets to the wall, gets to the ivy, and as he doesn't get the ball, hits the vines, and then in a perfectly timed moment, gets about two or three beers, it seems, poured right on top of him.
Which he probably enjoyed.
He probably, yes, may have given him some withdrawal.
It didn't make him smell worse, I can tell you that.
No doubt.
Yeah, he's so, to this day, through all of his missing teeth, he still bitches about the lights at Wrigley.
Well, they were antiquated, remember? Like I was watching a game the other day from the 80s, a night game. I don't know what it was, but it's funny how dark like the stands were. Well, like they only had lights.
It used to be true that there were only two stadiums in baseball that didn't have lights in the outfield. And that was Yankee Stadium and Wrigley Field. They both have the lights ring the top of the grandstand and shine out. And on TV, because when they shoot from behind home plate out, the light is being like thrown in front, everything's backlit, and so the bleachers always look dark as shit.
Mm-hmm.
They still does, do because right. They still don't have lights in the outfield.
And because the
new
bleachers,
Yankee Stadium has lights all over it, so really mm-hmm. is the only park that doesn't have. And they didn't know how they were. Honestly, they were still testing that shit. They were still repointing lights it's only the second time they'd ever played a game out there. So.
Well, 8788 was like a sort of like another. There's a lot of buildup, of course. I mean, the city council passed it in February. Like it all kind of happened in the previous year. But on 8788, they had like a VIP, probably for season ticket holders. So my cousin may have gone because he had the tickets then. But it was like a batting practice and like, you know, hobnobbing and like VIPs. And I remember Andre Dawson, like this was after the exhibition on August 7th, the night before, and kind of and so they were still adjusting on the fly, like particular bulbs within light stands to make sure, because there were blind spots on the field. There were, you know, it was far from perfect. And I think the other thing too, is you're right that without having the lights, you know, outside of the ringing of the bleachers that, you know, backlit the stands, they didn't have like the stands themselves were not really that wired for any of that sort of, they would eventually, I'm sure they retro, you know, nowadays it's a lot more well lit, I think, but it always, even for night games, it had unique, it was beautiful at night, and I, you know, it's a beautiful park, blah, blah, blah. I will say, to this day, they played a day game today, and I would love to have been there because, to me, there's still nothing better than a weekday afternoon game at Wrigley, made more intriguing by the fact that they're extremely rare now. That's most weekday games, non-holidays, are going to be Thursday, outside of the Friday, which itself is a tradition that remains. But the nights, they were beautiful. It was weird and a little dark and creepy, but there was, you know, the Wrigley was, you know, it wasn't like Soldier Field when you put a, you know, spaceship on top of the colony. They really somehow kept things continuous, let's say. Not that I'm any sort of an architectural maven, but
yeah, you'd really like to see the Cubs not fuck up the home Friday thing.
I like that. Day games at Wrigley are still
the Yankees king. Play as much as possible, play day games on Saturdays.
Mm-hmm.
That's a holdover from George. He thought weekend games should always be during the day. And so, you know, the Yankees are home if you hop in your car and flip on XM radio at like noon and there's a game, it's going to be them. Because they're usually the only team
playing. Most teams,
the Cubs have a home game, and then they follow right along.
Right, and the Sox, I noticed, played a day game last Saturday, but I think that's a little bit of an exception to some of the Sox. Like, they have night games and fireworks. Most teams, I think, probably more than most teams have more Saturday games at night than during the day. So Yankees and Cubs would be the exception there. And the other thing is when they, you know, what the Cubs have now is kind of in line now. They almost play as many night games as other teams elect to do, even with the Friday self-prohibition is, you know, accounts for one of the variances. But in the beginning, in 88, when it was approved and they were getting those lights up in February and March, they're only going to have 8 games that year. And then the agreement was between 1989 and, I don't know, for about 8 years or 10 years, only 18 games. And so to get to the point they're at now has been pretty incremental, and it went from 8 to 18 to like 28, and now it's a lot more of a semblance to it's still percentage wise less than any other ballpark as far as night games.
My little bit of free advice to the current regime is that if they're going to continue to put a shitty team on the field, they probably ought to up the number of day games because the tourists like the day games, and that's who you're going to be trying to sell tickets to unless you actually start to win some games.
Especially, yeah. I don't know how many tourists are there in April. The problem with that ballpark day or night is anywhere in the Midwest or April games, but I can think of fewer, more depressing places to be, frankly, even if the team's good sometimes, than a weeknight game in April at Wrigley Field. I'd rather go to a Bears game in December because at least more psychologically with it. But and I went to my first night game in 88. It was against the Mets, but it was not that series. They came back in September and the Cubs beat the Mets again, which would have whatever. I don't think it was the walk-off. It must have been. I don't remember it being a walk-off, but I'm sure that was a night game on September 7th. So mark that one. I don't remember the first Cubs game I ever went to because I'm sure I was being dragged to games before I could remember. But I do remember the first night game I went to was against the Mets in 88, and it was a walk-off. I just didn't remember that. I remember the walk-off the next year when Rick Rona suicide squeezed, but that was different. So I went to my first two Cubs-Mets nights games were both Cubs walk-off wins. I should have gone to more of those.
That's a good question. I wonder when my first night game was. I bet it was probably after I got to college.
91. Hey, you didn't have a lot of opportunity in the early years because they were only 18. And I'm sure those first couple of years, demand was high.
Well, yeah, it's a pain in the ass feeling.
And it's a pain in the ass, especially when the neighborhood
day games were easier to get.
Well, and I know this because my brothers, as I said, moved to that neighborhood. They had to get like parking passes because that was the first time you'd ever see neighborhood restrictions in 88, where it used to be like whatever, like you park wherever unless there's like a bus lane on Irving Park or whatever. And then all of a sudden, oh, we got lights. Well, I drive my car to Oak Brook and come back to my Lakeview apartment and I need a parking spot. And so the neighborhood put up that permit parking, which says you cannot park on these side streets at night unless you have, you know, a city sticker and a permit. So I remember my brothers had to scramble to get permits. I remember the first night game was a damn circus, as you can imagine, because even with all the preparation, it was like, you know, it was just kind of anarchy. But you know, they figured it out, and I can still go to night games to this day and not pay for parking. But I've got my secrets. I'm not going to publicize them.
So through some quick Googling here, I can tell you that I was not my first night game, but I went to a rare Saturday night game at Wrigley Field in 1996. It was June 9th.
Against the Phillies?
It was the Cubs and the Expos. And the reason I remember it was because the fog rolled in, and for where we were sitting, we couldn't see Sammy in right field. We were like sitting down kind of up behind the first base dugout, and that's how foggy it was. We just kept waiting for there to be a fog delay, and there never was.
Wow. We
just played through it. And apparently, Harry, as you'd be shocked to know, had a little trouble. He couldn't see what the hell was going on. So there's an article here by Bill Jouse.
Jousey.
Talking about how foggy it was. Foggy enough that fans seated by home plate could not read the center field scoreboard. Sammy lost a Mike Lansing pop-up, and it went for an RBI double. I remember that. In the sixth inning, they had a delay while Cubs coach Mako Oliveras hit fungos to the outfielders to see if they could see the ball. Luis Gonzalez caught one, and the game went on. Brian McRae said he couldn't see the ball for four innings.
You were at that game. I have no recollection of that game.
Yeah, I was there. The Cubs, I believe they won. I missed this in the very beginning. Yeah, Cubs won 6-4. Amari Telemaco pitched for the Cubs.
Oh, did you get the W?
Let's see.
Because Amari didn't get that many. He made his debut in 96, I'm pretty sure, but...
Mark Gray had drove in three runs in the pitching of 22-year-old Amari Telemaco. The Cubs beat the Expos 6-4, and fog so dense made an ordinary pop-up an adventure. Telemaco won. It was his third win of the year. And, oh, how about this? The losing pitcher for the Expos? Pedro Martinez.
Jeff's good. Ah, wow.
Amari out-dueled.
Right.
And Amari got screwed by Sammy losing a pop-up in the fog. He still beat Pedro.
He overcame that, proving Tommy was sort of right, too.
Yeah, Tommy's like, trade this fucker. He can't pitch in the fog.
I was going down the quick rabbit hole to just confirm. I do not remember a fellow by the name of Herm Starrett, who apparently was the Cubs pitching coach.
I remember Herm Starrett.
Do you really?
Yep. He was up there in the one season pitching coach. So he was Maddox's 15-3 pitching coach.
He
would have been 1 year like the great Marty Demerit.
Nice.
Which came much 10 years later.
One and done.
The year
before, there's Billy Connors, who was in with Fry, and he was not ushered out with Fry, so he hung on with, Stick Michael for the rest of that season. But, yeah, by the next season, Stick had replaced it with Herm Starrett. God, I don't remember Herm Starrett. I'm impressed that you do.
I just remember the name. I couldn't tell you what he looked like. Goof with glasses, but
yeah, Dick Pollitt was his first season.
I think Herm was a pitching coach maybe for the Expos first.
Yeah, now I'm starting to think I might remember the name elsewhere, not as the Cubs though. Let's see here, Herm Starrett, been dead since June 2nd, 2017. At least he lived to see the Cubs win the World Series.
Came to the Cubs from the Brewers.
As a coach, you're on some sort of baseball coaching reference.com. I can't find the coaches.
I Googled Herm Starrett and his Wikipedia page. Okay. He had been a pitching coach for the Braves, the Giants, the Phillies, the Brewers, the Cubs, and then after the Cubs, the Orioles, and then he was a bullpen coach for the Red Sox.
I love it. Absolute baseball
lifer.
He was succeeded.
He was the Cubs pitching coach in 87.
Yep.
Okay.
Succeeded by Dick Pohl.
Dick Pohl was the 88 pitching coach.
Okay. He was.
Oh, I see. Yeah, that's right. You're looking at who Gene Michaels' pitching coach was.
I was trying to bridge a gap between the rotund Billy Connors. Yeah. Billy Connors came back, by the way, I know that I didn't imagine that. But between Billy Connors and Dick Pohl, there was a Herm Starrett. I can rest easy now, Andy. Yeah.
Billy was a big boy with the Cubs the first time, but I remember when he came back.
We're talking Stay Puffed.
I remember my dad asking, it's like, because he would always wear like that windbreaker. He's like, do you think they even have a jersey big enough for him? I remember I had the same joke about Chris Bosio never wore his jersey. And I was like, do you think Bosio knows what number he is? Like, if you ask him, does he have any idea what number he is? He doesn't put that fucking jersey. He puts a jersey on for picture day and never puts it on again. And he wasn't that big. He was big, but he just didn't want to wear
Bosio wasn't. No.
Fazio was like, I'm the pitching coach. What the hell do I need to wear a jersey for? I'm not pitching.
Yeah.
I'm going to wear this thing. It's more comfy.
But Billy Connors.
I want pockets.
Billy but he wasn't that fat. Like you said, Billy Connors part two was, a little.
Yeah, he was huge.
Pretty big.
He was troubling. Looked like
it was.
Looked like John McSherry. Just about
and like right, right. It's speaking of Riverfront Stadium in opening days, in 1996. So we referenced one of Jim Frey's most horrific trades, which was really not done with any ulterior motive in mind or any political cover. It was just absolute baseball incompetence, and it bit him in the ass, and it propelled him. It compelled him for future trades to basically compounded the mistake.
It was a good old fashioned terrible trade.
But he made another trade during the season in 88, which shipped off the guy who looked like he was a very seamless center field transition from Bob Dernier, who had a very nice season in 1987, which we'll go more in depth because the wheel hasn't yet spun on 87. But when it does, we'll see one of Dallas Green's first real true products after Sean Dunstan, Dave Martinez, who suddenly, honestly, I'm just speaking, when I remember this happened in early 88, I was 16. I was probably not as so obsessed about the Cubs as maybe I was a couple years earlier. I was at that awkward age where I had a few interests, but I was following them extremely closely and remember being kind of puzzled. Why would we just deal Dave Martinez for Mitch Webster? And I don't know. Sometimes I still ask that question.
I remember we went to some games in 87, and I remember there were one of the hot selling items wore buttons with Dave Martinez's picture on them because the ladies liked the look of a young,
good-looking
Dave
kid.
Martinez.
Dude, and he was 20.
Apparently, they sold at least one of those buttons to one of the wives of one of the players.
Get out.
Maybe she didn't wear a button on her chest. She may have just worn Dave.
But seriously, Dave Martinez in 1987, and I would not, my wildest memory, have actually rosy-colored memory, have thought he did this well. But in 142 games, 520 plate appearances. I remember him coming up and playing every day and thinking, okay, he had a 459 at-bats. He had a 790 OPS. I'm just going to jump to the OPS for Christ's sake. He batted 292. He had a 372 on base. The guy was pre-Moneyball. And a 418 slugging, pretty goddamn good, especially in an era. I know he wasn't a shortstop, but center fielders weren't exactly known for power. I don't even think that I think I failed to appreciate Dave Martinez even in his own time in 1987. I have no idea how he didn't get Rookie of the Year votes.
Well, you could see why he'd be expendable, though. I mean, the long line of great Cubs center fielders, they were loaded with guys. So, you know, it's just... And the trade was clearly with the future in mind. They traded him for the young – oh, no, he was older. But, you know, Mitch was a switch hitter, and that's what they really needed.
Right.
They
were
switch hitting. They didn't need – no, it wasn't just – that was – Frey had identified. You know, we need another switch hitter.
Right. For a team that had a switch hitting catcher, they still needed another switch hitter. Yeah. And so it goes. And that was pretty – was that the straight-up trade, by the way? Did Jim Frey not even, like call a bluff? Like, did whoever was running the Expos –
Ellis Valentine or somebody?
He was already long gone with the Mets, but, like, I don't know who his counterpart was. Was it John McHale? Like, did he know that Frey may have been compromised or, like, had to sell low? How did – was there not another prospect in there? And when I look at it and I see – that it was straight up. Mitch Webster was the opening day left fielder in 89. Quickly replaced by Lloyd McClendon and Dwight Smith.
The 89 Cubs, the starting outfield, immediately fell apart physically. They had three. That's how we got Jerome Walton and Dwight Smith in the lineup every day.
I will say that if I actually were to give Jim Frey any credit, you could say, wow. He knew we had Jerome Walton on the way. By the way, Jerome Walton was not on anyone's radar. I already said that Dwight Smith and Mark Grace were, and Mike Harkey was a first-round pick. Jerome Walton kind of came out of nowhere. However, I'm also not inclined to think that Jim Frey was savvy enough to recognize that. I'm sure Jerome Walton's Rookie of the Year campaign the following year just fell right into that fucking Mr.
Magoo's. It was all fueled by the 30-game hit streak.
Was it all though? I mean, the guy was a goal.
No, I mean the third, he put up numbers during that streak. We've seen that. You know,
but he was a really good
rookie of the year.
Too.
You have good stats, and then if you have some other like hook, I mean, he had a good year, and everybody's like, "Oh, that's the guy with the 30 game hit streak." I'm about for him.
Yeah, I guess you're right. I mean, I haven't actually looked up Drew Malone's
his
numbers
were good enough to warrant winning Rookie of the Year. There's no doubt about
Waldens
it.
Waldens were.
Yeah.
Well, fuck. Yeah. Dave Martinez's numbers would seem to warrant getting some votes, but I don't see any. So
293. Well, actually, given what we know now, Jerome would not have won the Rookie of the Year if he had this season this year. 293 batting average.
Yep.
335 on base.
Crazy for not
385 slugs. So he didn't get on base and he didn't hit for any power.
But he wasn't above average.
He stole 24 bases and he had a 30 game hit streak. And he played on a division champion.
Which factors more for MVP and Cy Young than Rookie of the Year, supposedly.
Let's see. That's great. We're talking about this in 89, but why not?
We've already done 89. We may have missed it before. And I will just say while you look it up that Walton was, he made an error on opening day and then went like 120 games without another. He was a very good defensive center fielder, which.
So we know who finished. We know who finished second Rookie of the Year voting.
In 89 or 88?
89.
Dwight Smith.
So for the second year in a row, the Cubs had the second place finisher.
As I said,
they had the first place.
Right.
This guy.
Well, as I tried to say, maybe ineloquently, they would also have a second place finisher in 1990 in Mike Harkey.
The runaway favorite for the award going into the season finished third. He had been a playoff hero in '88, and he didn't have enough games played to qualify, so he got to be a rookie again in '89. Do you remember who that was?
Greg Jeffries
of the Mets, who everyone thought was going to be a superstar.
He got votes in 88 and 89, but he didn't technically qualify. He still technically qualified as a rookie in 89.
Yeah, well, you can win it twice, I guess.
I guess, right.
Do you remember who, now I'm looking at 89, so that's for a different time. We
I'm hoping for that. Move over Archie Griffin. I want to find the
but
first
that brings
two
up a good point. I want to see now how close did the far inferior Chris Sabo come?
Yeah, what were Sabo's number? I just know, you know, he looked like, you know, Spuds McKenzie was a thing.
Sabo got 11 first place votes and Mark Grace got 7.
Okay, that was close.
Sabo had a much higher war. He had a 5.1 war. He hit 271. Grace hit 296. He had a 314 on base. Grace 371. He had a 414 slug. Grace had 403. Grace had a higher OPS. Sabo hit 11 homers and drove in 44 runs. Grace, 7 homers and drove in 57 runs.
So what accounts
Sabo
for the different
stole
reward?
46 bases. I didn't know that.
Wait, what? They both what? Did you say stole 46 bases?
Sabo
you say?
Stole 46 bases.
In his career?
No, in that season.
Oh. So there's that and the fact that he probably was a good glove man.
He was an excellent glove man. But we also know Mark Grace was one of the best.
Correct, but third base is probably a little more critical. I mean, they're critical in different ways. I don't know if that still accounts for the vast difference in war, but fine. Wasn't enough that Chris Sabo could play in the All-Star game in his home stadium as a rookie. He had to also take home the Rookie of the Year.
So he stole 46 bases. In 89, he got hurt. He only played 82 games. He stole 14. He stole 25 in 90. He was an All-Star.
And a World Series champ.
He stole 19 in 91, and he was an All-Star.
And he ended up as a White Sox in like 95.
Pretty much dropped off the cliff after that. Yeah, he played for the White Sox in 95, but only 20 games. And he played for the Cardinals in 95 on that hilarious dog shit Cardinal team. That
Mike Jorgensen.
Was trading away stars like Todd Zeal. And he returned to Cincinnati for his final season at 34. And
so Grace had a better career. So up yours, Chris Sabo.
Yeah. Let's see. Did any Cubs get MVP votes in 1988?
I bet you Sandberg probably got a couple.
One Cub got
Maddox.
6 votes. Andre Dawson.
Oh.
Coming off of his MVP season.
And
somebody threw him a 6th place vote or whatever.
Somewhat historical season he was coming off of. Yeah, it was only Hawk's second year. But he already owned right field.
He played 157 games. He hit .303, but he only had 24 homers and 79 RBIs. So a huge jump.
That's a lot of games. Go easy on those knees, Zim. He had some depth, right? You got Palmeiro up in left field.
This was the 88 Cubs, the same team that kept pumping Maddox out there for extra innings because their bullpen was terrible. And then he burned out. Let's see. Cy Young? Because I wonder if Greg hung on to get any. He did not.
No, really?
Well, the Cy Young, actually, this was a pretty good
Guess. The Cy Young award was Oral Hershiser.
Yes.
Right?
Oral had set the had broken Don Drysdale's consecutive scoreless inning streak.
Like during a pennant stretch, too. But during, like, down in September.
Right. And then we remember he was ridiculous in the playoffs in the World Series.
Came out of the bullpen. He won a game, saved a game. It's one of the most. I saw something on HBO or ESPN a couple of years ago. It's worth a look if you haven't seen. Just Oral Hershiser, not a Hall of Famer. I don't think. I'm sure he didn't deserve to be. But the 88 season alone. Pretty. Okay,
so I'm not gonna tell you who it is, but I'm gonna tell you the comparison between the first place Cy Young voter. Vote getter, which is Oral, and the second place guy. So Oral won 23 games. The guy who finished second won 23 games. Oral lost 8 games. The guy who finished second also lost 8 games. Oral's ERA was 2.26. This guy was 2.73. They both tied for the league with 15 complete games. Oral threw 8 shutouts. This guy threw 6. Oral had a save. This guy didn't. Oral threw 267 innings. The guy who finished second, 260 and two-thirds innings. Oral gave up 208 hits. This guy gave up 206.
Goodness.
Let's see. What else?
I have a guess, but I don't think it's right.
One guy had Oral had 178 strikeouts. This guy had 161. Oral faced 1,068 batters. That led the league. This guy faced 1,034. Oral's ERA was 149. This guy's was 132. So who finished second?
Is it Doc Gooden?
It is not. It is a future Cub.
Danny Jackson?
It's Danny Jackson. He basically matched Oral pitch for pitch.
Holy shit.
In 1988.
That's a story for the Reds.
Yep.
Wow.
And he would cash that in a couple of years later.
Yeah, he sure would. Yeah, we would pay the price
awful,
for that.
Come be awful for the Cubs.
Yes.
That's probably
would
why.
He would literally be the nail in Jim Fry's coffin.
Lou Piniella was out there just telling him to keep throwing. Everything's fine.
That's incredible. In 88, Danny Jackson was that. You know, we went over Danny Jackson's numbers when we talked about him recently, and I guess I didn't realize I still say Hershiser, which is incredible, just probably because of the way that he finished. But, well, there you go, Danny Jackson.
He was almost as good for the 92 Cubs. Well, let's see. He came to the Cubs in 91. He was 1-5 with a 6.75 ERA and 17 starts. In 92. He made 19 starts. He was 4-9.
And they got traded for Steve Buschel. Yeah. So you know who the Reds manager was in 88?
Oh, so it wasn't Lou yet. It was...
No, Lou won it all in his first year.
In 90. Oh, that's right. So 88.
Who managed Danny Jackson to this epic season? And the follow-up question is, how much money do you think he won as a result?
Oh, Pete Rose. Pete Rose. That's right. I forget. That's who Lou succeeded.
He did.
Was there anybody in between? Did Rose get? I forget when Rose.
No. Right, well, so Rose got vanquished in like August of '89.
Yeah. So there's somebody in the interim.
Yeah, and then they brought in Piniella to clean house, and they won it all. And it was not a bad team. And you know, it's funny. Not that I expected to go here. Pete Rose was not actually, if you look at the numbers, the worst manager. He was brought on he's the last player manager in our lifetime, the first since Don Kessinger of the Sox. He actually made his debut against the Cubs. He was chasing Ty Cobb's record, so it was a little bit of a sort of a circus show. He makes his debut as a player. He comes back from the Expos 2 months after hitting a ball off of Lee Smith's ass that Dave Owen caught out of the air and ended up in a iconic Cubs game-ending double play. And he goes back to Cincinnati, where he had played before you and I could remember, because our first memory of Pete Rose, no doubt, was as a member of the Phillies. But he, of course, made his mark with his hometown Reds, and he comes home, and he's the manager, the player manager, and he played a lot in 84 and 85. But yeah, he debuted against the Cubs, and then he was the manager in 85, 86, 87, 80. He was a manager like almost as long as any Cubs manager had been in their lifetime. And the Reds were not really ever shitty. I mean, Tom Browning was not a rookie of the year in 88, but he was the first player to win 20, pitcher to win 20 games since Bob Grimm in 1954 for the New York Yankees. And obviously Danny Jackson. So the Reds had 2 20 game winners. I don't know why they weren't even more competitive. Maybe Pete was pulling the reins on the proverbial horse at some junctures of the season, whatever. But the Reds are not terrible. Rose's managerial record is not terrible, but he was run out the following year, and they obviously had a good nucleus. I mean, Barry Larkin, there's another guy. I mean, they had some players in 88, and they won it all in 90, and it wasn't a fluke. They did upset a overwhelming favorite Oakland A's team, but even without Billy Hatcher's cosmic production, that Reds team was pretty good, and they were mostly together in 88. So,
okay, so you remember this. So the 88, I was looking, because you look at Pete Rose's managerial record, and the Reds finished second a lot under him. But what caught my eye was in 1988, he was, they show how many managers there were. 90 and 89, he was the first of two managers. Because during the season, he got suspended for life, and Tommy Helms took over for him. But in 1988, he was listed as the first of three managers and the third of three managers.
Is that the year in which he bumped Dave Pallone?
Yeah, he got suspended for 30 games in the middle of the season.
You remember the cover of Sports Illustrated, right?
What it said.
There was an SI cover. It was banned. And I don't know if this is anything to do with anything, but Dave Pallone years later become one of the first, people in sports to come out of the closet. So I don't know if that was brought up. I don't know if it was relevant or what, but Dave Pallone was definitely the umpire. He was one of those guys you always knew about. He was a National League umpire here. He'd announce him along with like Dick Stello and Dutch Rennert for the games. He was pretty well known for National League fans. And Rose went pretty damn nuts. So what do you suppose they talked about in that conversation? Like, do you know how much money I had? insert your own joke. I don't know. There is the SI cover, though. I got to find it. It's driving me crazy. But, yeah, banned for 30 games.
Pete got banned, and this would be shocking to know for you. The Reds radio announcers Marty Brenneman, good old Franchester, and Joe Nuxhall were criticized for inciting the fan response because fans threw crap onto the field. With what were characterized as inflammatory and completely irresponsible remarks. Especially given Brenneman and Nuxhall's iconic status in Cincinnati, and that it was common for spectators at ballparks to listen to their team's radio broadcast using portable radios. So basically,
yeah,
Marty could get them fired up and get them throwing shit on the field. Way to go. Way to go, Marty.
Prick. Maybe drop in on a few F-bombs, or maybe even Marty wouldn't go that low. Or homophobia. Nobody knew Dave Pallone was gay in 1988, but that came out later. But yeah, it was, what is it, May? It was May. The cover of SI said suspended 30 days. Yeah, that's pretty big news.
Yeah.
Pete was probably under duress.
So do you know who got the first hit in a night game in Wrigley Field history?
8-9-88. Would it be the aforementioned Lenny Dykstra?
It was Mark Grace.
Oh.
Mets went down.
Had a boy, Grace.
Mets went down 1-2-3 in the fly ball, strikeout, ground ball. And Don Zimmer's great lineup. Sean Dustin was leading off. He flew out to center. Ryan flew out to right. And Mark Grace singled. And then Dawson flew out.
Okay. You should maybe
Lenny
consider...
homered in the...
Who did? Dawson did?
Lenny Dykstra homered.
Dykstra did. Okay. I will say, as a ball player, Dykstra is one of those guys that did rise to the challenge. Did rise to the occasion, I should say. Often, it seemed.
So I guess he must have hit the... I don't have any Cubs homer, do they? Nope. So Dykstra hit the first official home run in Wrigley Field history.
And, how about that?
And Ho-Ho, Howard Johnson, hit the second off Pat Perry. So Cubs won.
Pat Perry, who had been acquired for Leander. I got that wrong. I keep getting it wrong. Pat Perry... it doesn't matter. Because Leon Durham was, Pat Perry was acquired.
Yeah, from the
Durham Reds. Was traded. After Grace showed up, played in San Diego, wore number 28, and then they were like, okay, you can stay. Here's 17. Now we got to trade Bull. And then we got Pat Perry. That's what it was.
And then Leon went out and said, where's my manager? Suspended.
Oh, I'm going to go party.
Yep. Call me when Pete gets back.
Right. I was gonna say 88 Tom Browning, but then I'm like, no, wait, Tom Browning was a rookie in 88 and he won 20 games. He did not stand on the roof. We already mentioned that he did it in 93, stand in front of the portico on the roof on Sheffield during a game.
So Vance Law in his all-star season was hitting 302 at the all-star break. 362 on base, 411 slug. In the second half, he hit 284 with a 354 on base and a 413 slug. He basically had the same.
Oh.
He did not fade, although he only.
It's another Mandela effect. Kind of like, by the way.
He was terrible in 89. Terrible. That's why they had to go out and get Luis Salazar.
Right. That's what it was. He actually had a pretty good season most of the year.
Vance, of course, played at BYU, and I believe he might still be their baseball coach.
Yeah, he is a Mormon, I'm pretty sure. His father, Vernon Law, pretty sure a member of the 1960 World Championship Pirates.
And his brother, Rudy, played with him on the
They were teammates together.
The 83 White Sox.
Right, they were like a regular Alou brother, the local connection.
They must be fraternal twins. They don't look a lot alike.
No, Rudy didn't have the big glasses for starters. I mean, even like if you look at the 88 Cubs and like they list players by WAR, just look at Vance Law's profile. It's like really, are you not afraid you're going to fry your eyeballs with those things? So those Sally Jesse Raphael glasses you got on your head. Oh, by the way, his dad was his dad's only 20 win season. Was in 1960. So Vernon Law threw 18 complete games, led the league, and won the Cy Young. Did not know that Vernon Law was a Cy Young Award winner for a World Series champion, and his son was a 1988 All-Star.
So Damon Berryhill was the primary catcher. Jody Davis was still around. He played in 88 games. And Jim Sundberg played 24 games for the Cubs.
It was Sundberg's second season. It always seemed like a weird acquisition. Sundberg was like a guy that I only recognized through baseball cards because I was not an American League fan. So I never saw the Texas fucking Rangers. But Jim Sundberg was like the day in and day out, everyday catcher for the Rangers. Apparently, I found out later he was an Illinois native from Galesburg, you know, Carl Sandburg's domain. And yeah, kind of came home to Illinois when he was still sort of in his prime. It always seemed weird that Dallas Green would have brought him on. I believe Sundberg came out in 87 to the Cubs, but it seemed like he was still like an everyday catcher unless up until that point.
Yeah, he caught 140 games for the 86 Royals.
He'd gone to Kansas City for a year. Okay.
He won 6 gold gloves with the Rangers.
Wow, really good catcher. Yeah, so it felt like a luxury, actually, at the time to have Jody and Sundberg. They were both, like, everyday catchers. And then, again, prospect pervert alert. We've got Damon Berryhill. Again, Cubs had prospects seemingly at every position. And Berryhill was, you know, if he stayed healthy, could have been a good player. He did hit a homer for the Braves in the 91 World Series. Just, you know, I think we bemoaned the sad fate of Damon Berryhill. Things might have gone a little bit differently if we had him as catcher in 89. And not Rick Rona, Joe Girardi.
Tandem of Joe Girardi and Rick Rona, both batting with balsa wood bats.
It would Burial head pop. I mean, he's a big guy, or is he big? It says here he's only 6 foot 205. That's still pretty big by 1988 standards. I see one name on that roster, by the way, before we wrap it up at some point. I forgot to mention the third player that the Cubs got when they traded Steve Trout after his consecutive shutouts. I mentioned the never-remembered Dean Wilkins and Rich Scheid, but the young Yankee prospect that I remember being excited about that would go on to have great success after he did nothing with the Cubs, Bob Tewksbury, member of the 88 Cubs. Somehow discovered himself with the Joe Torre, Mike Jorgensen Cardinals and had saved some face professionally before he retired.
So the primary rotation for the Cubs, I can't imagine why they only won 77 games. Greg Maddux, Rick Sutcliffe, that's pretty good. Jamie Moyer, 9-15, but with a 3.48 ERA. Then Calvin Schiraldi and then Al Nipper made 12 starts.
This Jim Frey's dream rotation.
You know,
40% of that Lee Smith.
They don't have a lot of starts. I kind of wonder. Maddux started 34 games, Sutcliffe 32, Moyer 30. So that's not But then it's
weird.
You got
Pico.
Nipper. I guess Pico made 13, and then Harkey and Blackie both made 5. I guess that
makes sense. A less lackmaster.
I was thinking Don was throwing Greg out there on short rest, just trying to wear him out.
No, but it is interesting that Maddux had such a precipitous drop off. I just remember how white hot he just suddenly became. It was exciting.
Yes, we talked about the walks. He walked 81 in 88. He walked 82 in 89. He walked 71 in 90, 66 in 91, 70 in 92. Then he left the Cubs. And then listen to his walks after he leaves the Cubs. 52, 31, 23. 23 walks in 28 starts.
What year is that?
That's 1995.
Yeah, strike short year. That's why you had fewer
28,
starts.
20. There's 20 walks in 33 starts in 1997. 45, 37, 42, 27 in... He's 35 years old. He walks 27 guys in 34 starts in 2001. 45, 33. He comes back to with the Cubs. 33, 36, and 37. Jeez.
Man.
He never walked a lot of guys. But
he kept refining it. You're right. He showed up. That progression is the sign of a guy that continued to learn how to pitch. He never stopped learning. I know it sounds cliche, but it's fucking true. I mean, in 1988, it was a bright hot star. He'd win a Cy Young for the Cubs 4 years later. And then even then, we would be totally forgiven if we did not project what would come, because who the hell could have when he 94, 95, 96? That's just like, that's
certainly not Stanton Cook. We know that.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, he's not worth that much money. $28 million for 5 years? Oh, come on. What are we just, throwing money around?
Maddux and Moyer.
He didn't want to leave. The fact they had agreed to a deal and the Cubs took it to Stanton, he said it's too much.
It was all dysfunctional by then. Bear in mind, this was earlier that that whole much that I've discussed is mediocrity by design. It was, if it happened a couple years earlier, maybe it would have saved their asses. But Jim Frey really torched the franchise, and then ownership just they just curtailed everything. And Maddux not continuing as a Cub is essentially a result of all that. That whole chain of events. It all goes back to Dallas Green, who drafted Greg Maddux. And Maddux would have been a Cub had Green been there. But
Let's see, 88 Manny Trio was still knocking around.
Crazy.
On his second stint, which lasted 3 seasons. He would finish up the next year in Cincinnati. Leon Durham only played 24 games before he got traded.
Salud, Leon.
Angel Salazar, the shortstop, played 34 games for the Cubs.
Just a teaser of Luis the next year.
Everybody's favorite Cub, Dave Meyer, Played in two games for them. He was a.
I'm looking at that. That's MEIR, and I guarantee you right now that I have a top. I'm sure that's the same guy of whom I have a Topps baseball card from 5 years earlier as a member of the Seattle Mariners, Bunting. Maybe I'm wrong. Nope, he didn't play for the Mariners. Never mind.
Twins.
Maybe it was a twin card. Yeah, that's my only hope. Otherwise, carry on.
Let's see. I can run through the pitcher. I guess we pretty much got through the pitchers. Yeah, Jeff Pico, Frank DePino, who would become such good friends with Mark Grace that they would get in a fight when Frank went to the Cardinals, and it would end up separating or at least dislocating Grace's shoulder.
Although,
in the fight.
I will say Grace did, you know, Grace kind of kicked his ass in that fight, even though he fucked himself's shoulder up. He took him down. So you don't often see that in baseball fights, if ever. No, like actual fights is my point. Yeah, DePino, how many innings did he pitched a lot? He was actually a useful pitcher for the Cubs in this.
Yeah, 90 innings in 63 games.
Yeah.
He wasn't just a loogie. He was giving you.
No.
Yeah, he had been a he was an 86 Astro, right?
Yeah.
Oh, he came to the Cubs in 86. He got traded. Oh, he got traded off that team. He must have loved that.
Oh, man.
Was it for Billy Hatcher?
I bet you it was. Let's find out. Let's bring this shit full circle. Guarantee you. It's got to be. Da, 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 da. No.
Davey
Lopes. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that hurts.
So close.
Hatcher might have playoff team so that a 43-year-old Davey Lopes can.
43-year-old who still managed to steal some 50-odd bases in 1985. Oh, thank you very much. Now, Billy Hatcher, by the way. Oh, well, Billy Hatcher was traded by the Cubs way earlier, after 85, for Jerry Mumphrey.
Yeah. Oh, Jerry Mumphrey. Well,
I can't fault that. We got like a ready-made player for a guy that would just turn out to be a postseason stud, which proved to not be relevant for the Cubs of those years. So.
The 88 Cubs also had a guy who had been the third overall pick in the 1984 draft.
Drew Hall.
Left-handed.
No, I'm sorry.
Yes. Left-handed pitcher out of Moorhead State. Drew Hall. He was taken ahead of guys like Corey Snyder.
Cover of SI in 87.
Eric Pappas, who would pitch for the Cubs.
We talked about a catcher, wasn't he? Or was he a pitcher?
Right. Catcher Eric Pappas. That's Milt, his old man. That's what I was thinking.
Right.
Jay Bell. Some guy named Mark McGuire.
Yep.
Oda B. McDowell.
84 is Greg Maddux, too. Greg Maddux was like 15th or maybe third or fourth round. Maddux was drafted in 84. I'm almost sure of it. But you'd have to dig a little bit to find it.
Oda B. McDowell, who I like just because of the name. And he played in the Olympic team.
And we all have the Oda McDowell Topps USA baseball card. Yeah.
Terry Mulholland was the 24th pick.
The Cubs.
Norm Charlton was the 28th. But Drew, that was
probably an 88 red. Certainly a 1990 red. Greg Maddux was the second round pick in 84.
Yeah, I thought he was the second round pick.
Yep. So they went Drew Hall and Greg Maddux. But again.
Much like the draft they just had where they took Cade Horton in the first round, and then they took Jackson Ferris, the high schooler, in the second round. That's kind of the same thought. They save a little money in the first round on the college pitcher, and then they get the high school pitcher, and he goes to Hall of Fame. So
because Drew Hall was a celebrated Olympian, even though he was not deemed worthy to have his own Topps card like Oda B. McDowell or Mark McGuire.
I mean, the reason that I clicked on Drew Hall, I thought it was him. The Cubs had a guy around this time who had a season where his ERA was infinity. And it wasn't Drew.
Oh.
But I remember looking at the Topps card, and it had the sideways, you know, they had the infinity symbol on the card.
No, they did not have. I'm questioning your memory.
Yes.
I would think that they would have just a dash.
Uh-uh. It had, I had to figure out what the sideways eight was.
Are you sure that was in Flair, and that was like their celebrated feature?
But I know I had a baseball card that had the infinity Donruss sign on the baseball card.
Okay, gotta look because I'm sure there are plenty of pitchers in the last 20 years. You could find an infinity ERA, however they represent it on Baseball Reference, and then find that card.
Well, it had to be around the mid. It would had to have been around the 80s.
But it wasn't Drew Hall. You've already ruled him out.
Well, no, he doesn't have a season on here where he had an infinity. He had 456, 689, 766, 370, 509.
Yeah. Yeah, he wasn't infinite. No infinite. God, you know, God, Drew Hall, actually, I don't even remember him coming. I remember being excited about him, but he pitched in 45 games for the Cubs in parts of 86, 87, 88. You'd think I'd remember that because I would have been excited because he was a first-round pick. But I think the thing is he kind of struggled, and he was out of college. So the fact that he wasn't called up till 86 – probably a sign that, maybe he's not so good. And then, you know, he was, quite frankly, when you bemoan the trade that Jim Fry would make after the season in which he dealt Jamie Moyer and Rafael Palmeiro and Drew Hall, and that was all that he gave up. We got back one good year from Mitch Williams. Paul Kilgus sucked, but we did get Steve Wilson, the left-handed Canadian,
yep,
sort of reliever, and he was kind of the Drew Hall analog. You know, just where like Kilgus was the Moyer analog at the time. And I don't know, whatever you compare Palmeiro to, the Wild thing. But I remember like Steve Wilson was a much more effective Cub than Drew Hall ever was for the Rangers. So that part of the win. There's a W in your column, Jim Fry.
I also remember Steve Wilson used to hide behind his glove on the mound. Kind of John Lester-esque.
Okay.
You know, he had it spread real wide, and he kind of peered over the top of it while he was looking for the sign. I remember that. I remember he had to make a big spot start for the 89 Cubs, and he came up big. And
he was very useful. He was like a really Steve Wilson. I don't know if we gave him his due in 89, but he was as a young guy thrown into the fire like a Les Lancaster and Jeff Pico. He did just well. And I also am remiss to have not mentioned Curtis Wilkerson. Jim Fry also finagled Curtis Wilkerson out of that. So,
but let's see here.
God, I hope I didn't forget anything. I talked about John Cangelosi throwing me a ball when I was distracted.
So I think it's the 88. I think I found the spot start that I was so September 10th. Cubs at home against the Cardinals. Steve Wilson started, pitched five innings.
You're 1989, yeah, right?
Five innings, four hits, one run, and he struck out 10. I'm positive that was it. Big win for the Cubs, who, let's see, I don't know what the...
And you were there, or you just remember the game?
No, I just remember it. That's what I remember. If you asked me about Steve Wilson, I remember...
Well, it's good. We did not remember that... Well, no, that's fair. We did not remember that crap when we did 1989.
Oh, yeah, so the Cubs had a 1.5 game lead over the Cardinals and pushed it to 2.5 with that win in September. So
I'm glad you brought that up. That's actually probably Steve Wilson's finest moment as a Cub, actually. Yeah, so far, far better than whatever Drew Hall provided for the 86, 87, or 88 Cubs. None of it matters. I just know if the 88 Cubs were entertaining, things would get better. And then we just couldn't recognize it at the time, but the mechanism was already being dismantled to prevent real long-term success. So it's really bittersweet to look at. So I have fond memories of it. Lights went on. The team was young and good. And we just didn't know that our legs were already the trapdoor was opening slowly.
Well, and they had in the playoffs, they ran into the Giants, who were Roger Craig had taught them all the split finger fastball. Not like they also were spitting all over the ball. We know they were. They were cheating.
Sure.
Blatantly cheating. The Cubs should have won the pennant. They were robbed of it.
Either way, my point is, wouldn't it matter because Jim Fry was in charge. It would have all been, unless they won it all that year.
But if you think about it, it probably is a good thing that it happened, because if the Cubs win the pennant, game two of the World Series is at Wrigley Field. And all those commuters in San Francisco are heading home at the normal time, and they all die in an earthquake.
Cubs saved the world.
Cubs saved at least the city of 850,000 San Franciscans.
Yep. Yep. You're welcome.
Yep. I guess they gave it back to us in the ninth inning of game.
They did.
In 2016. Yeah. They paid the... Bruce Bochy said, "I'm just going to use every one of my relief pitchers for one batter and see if you can score four runs." Oh, you did, and we lost. So.
Right. It was bound to happen, but it all evened out. I just happened to notice that there was a game on May 14th in which The winning pitcher. You remember the Houston left-hander Bob Nepper?
Oh yeah,
good pitcher. I remember. In fact, when we got Al Nipper, I'm like, oh, please tell me it's that left-hander Bob Nepper, not that shitbag for the Red Sox. And the losing pitcher, of course, was Al Nipper on May 14th. I just happened to spy that. Nipper. Yeah. Al Nipper did not factor into too many games. But yeah, that was part of me does think that that Lee Smith trade does not get enough attention as just being one of the most atrocious trades in baseball history, let alone club history. So,
oh, he only had like 300 saves after they traded
him. Yeah. Not that it might have made a difference in 88. It's more about the cascading effects.
Well, the biggest thing about that is it's one thing to trade him. It's another thing to get nothing, which is what they got.
They got nothing, but then you had to trade later, Palmeiro and Moyer, to fix the hole.
Right, they had to chase the failure. So it cost you.
Yeah. Granted, Palmeiro didn't really have a position. I mean, you could have found a spot for him.
He was an adequate left fielder. He'd been fine.
Yeah. And, you know, and maybe his libido factored into it. Who knows? But you still could have gotten.
See, that's
more
another
than
thing. If you don't have to trade Palmeiro then, and you keep him, and then you decide later, all right, he really should be a first baseman for somebody. He's a more established player. You get more for him.
Yeah.
And I did look it up. He wasn't leading the league in hitting at the All-Star game. I believe he was. Sitting second there. He was sitting 311 at the break when he made the All-Star team.
Nice.
And he finished up at 307. So.
Yeah, he was a guy where he was a first-round pick himself. I'm thinking 85.
Former,
maybe
college teammate of Will Clark and Jeff Brantley.
Well,
Mississippi
and Bobby
State.
Bobby Thigpen.
Oh, and Bobby Thigpen. Well, they were loaded.
Jeff Brantley also on that team?
Yeah, the Cowboy. I'm positive Jeff Brantley was on that.
Jeff Brantley, I remember chatting him up in the bleachers when he was at the Reds in 96. I was doing a lot of chatting back then. He was pretty funny. Wow.
Yep.
Yeah, that Mississippi State team. Because, yeah, they would bring that up constantly, right? Because it was always a little bit confusing. It was like, Will Clark's the guy in the Giants. Our guy's Mark Grace, who didn't really go to college. But Palmeiro was also a first baseman, left-handed guy, played with Palmeiro.
So that one team had four legit, you know, like Palmeiro would have been in the Hall of Fame if he hadn't fucked
yes.
it up.
He's,
Will Clark, borderline Hall of Famer, was never going to make it because it's
borderline Hall of Famer. Again, with the Harold Baines principle, they're all Hall of Famers.
Bobby Thigpen, who for a long time was the single season save leader, and then Brantley played for like 15 years.
He was the primary closer for at least a couple teams. Will Clark's WAR 56.5. That's higher than Harold Baines. I don't think I have to look up Palmeiro's, but out of curiosity, I even wonder if Bobby Thigpen's more.
Well, and then they had the ironic thing we talked about in 03. When the Cubs tried to trade for Palmeiro and he wouldn't go.
Yeah.
And the reason was he didn't want to leave Texas, and the Rangers were trying to tell him that we're not bringing you back, and he wouldn't believe them. And he stayed, and then not only did they let him go, who did they replace him with? Will Clark.
Yeah.
His old college teammate. And he went to Baltimore, and he had big years for the Orioles, but he didn't want to go. So.
He had big years for the Orioles, not after 03, you're saying. He was at the end in 03, right?
He went back to Baltimore. So he go back to Baltimore?
Well, because he was,
that,
a,
right?
he was Baltimore. 96,
gave him
90,
the,
right, he was the big free
gave
agent
him the
signing
needle
Baltimore.
In the butt, and he flunked his steroid
test. That would have to be his second time, right? Because he actually had Cubs, Rangers, and I think his greatest success was actually Baltimore, right? Or he had some real good success. He really emerged in.
Yeah, he came back. So he went. He played for the Cubs until 80 through 88. Then he was with the Rangers until 93. Then he went to the Orioles. Then he came back to the Rangers.
So the point is,
and then he went back to the Orioles when they said, "Okay, you can go now."
Electing to go back to Baltimore instead of electing to go back to Chicago.
Yeah, well, he didn't. He thought he was going to just stay in Texas. He didn't want to leave.
Right.
And the Rangers were trying to tell him the reason we're trading you is you're not in our plans anymore. And he's like, "Ah, of course I am." And he wasn't. And if you believe him, that's exactly what happened. He goes to Baltimore. He plays with Miguel Tejada. Miguel gives him, hey, I'm. You know,
that's what
he
got
wants
implicated.
Some vitamin B, and he took some vitamin B right at the old, you know.
Well, because he was 39, 40. Right. He was, he was over 500 homers, but suddenly 500 homers wasn't seeming so unique. He just
was chasing the three. He was trying to hang on to get his 3,000th hit.
And yeah, he barely got 3,000 hits. That's
and that's when he claims that he took the stuff that flunked the test.
Oh, career bad choices. Hopefully, he got crabs from Cindy too. On top of it all,
I would think most. I think most of the team did.
Because I feel like we suffered from his bad choices. Because you know, not that Jim Frey wouldn't have given him away anyway, but felt like Jim Frey was forced to deal with Palmeiro, and I put that on Raffy. Not on the siren that may have enticed
How much
him.
Better are the 80, 90, 91 Cubs if they have Dave Martinez and Rafael Palmeiro playing center?
Oh, my gosh. I could live without Mark Reyes. Yeah.
Instead of Dwight or, and Jerome, who were good, but weren't as good as those two guys.
Or even flip Palmeiro to first and let, you know, you don't want Dwight Smith as your everyday outfielder.
Well, no, you got...
Could have had them both. He would have been a fine outfielder.
Probably needed to have Mark Reyes on that team, too. So.
Yeah, keep Grace. I'm sure he's a better glove man than Palmeiro was. You could have flipped Smith, who was a great hitter, and just not a good outfielder, and you know, built it. But that's presuming, of course, Andy, that we had a good general manager.
We did. No, we had the guy who'd been the manager, and then was proving to be a complete dullard on the radio.
Right, in no way qualified to be GM. It was such a lazy move.
So did they replace? Did he get replaced on the Cub radio team by Dave Nelson? Do you remember that?
Dave Nelson was the radio guy in '89. Yeah. So yeah, I guess he would have been.
Oh, he was atrocious.
Yeah, you're right. So Fry would have stepped in during that time in which like Vince Lloyd and Lou Boudreau quietly disappeared. So at some point, Dwayne Statz was having to hold it down with Jim Fry, right?
Yeah, maybe for only a year. Maybe just 87, and then 87. At the end of the season, he takes over as the GM.
Yes, 87 would be the year, and then would have been replaced. Maybe Davey Nelson did 2 years, 88, 89, because I know Davey Nelson did it with Dwayne in 89, and Dwayne left after 89, after which point they recreated
the whole
thing
with Brennan,
Brantley, and Santo. Yeah, I think you nailed it there. We struggled piecing it together and boring people to death with the whole Dwayne Statz, Vince Lloyd, Lou Boudreau thing in the mid-80s, but you pretty much got it. I think it was just 1 year. 87, because he got fired in 86, comes back 87, he's still in good graces, and then he's the GM after. So he was never really gone. He just got progressively more destructive.
Yeah, right. They put him in a position where he could do more harm.
Right. And so it goes.
All right. Well, there they were. The 88 Cubs, I remember they were they were giving us hope. Like, there were young, good players. Maddox had a great year. We liked Grace.
And it was legit hope.
We thought Andre, we didn't realize Andre's knees. It basically.
Andre would produce for a few more years. But yeah, he was coming off an MVP season, so nobody would be convinced that he was on the downside in 88.
Well, his whole 89 season is clouded by the fact that he had no business playing in the playoffs. His knees were shot. And he kept coming up in huge spots. And
we broke it down. It was heartbreaking because you couldn't be mad at him, and it was just one just bad time. It was one bad season. He was so awesome every other year. It was definitely 88 was definitely a year in which we had hope, and it was justified. It wasn't dumb hope. It wasn't like 91 where it all turned to dust. It was like, yeah, they built on it, and you know they could have built on it more, but other factors were in play.
Yeah, problem was I picked a dope to be the guy trying to build the
roster. So,
all right.
Alrighty.
Well, there's 1988, and we're hitting in the home stretch here. So
there we go. We'll put it in the books.
All right. Well, see you next time.
See you, Andy. Thanks.
Many of us have herpes.